It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk with Broadway legend and UW alumnus Andre DeShields about his award-winning role in the musical Hadestown.
First, if you've ever have had difficulties at work with a boss or a fellow employee or have questions about pay, training, and professional development, the HR department is supposed to help solve those problems.
Unfortunately, not all HR departments are created equal, and not every American workplace even has one. Among the most common HR-related matters at work include turnover and retention, generational conflict, diversity and inclusion, and the Me Too movements.
Our next guest is here to talk about solutions employees and employers can pursue to create a better work environment.
Jeanette Black is an associate professor in the Department of Operations and Management at UW-Stout. She's also a senior-level human resources and organizational development professional. Jeanette, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So how would you describe the purpose of a human resources department?
That individual is really kind of the backbone of the organization. They're the employee advocate. They're the employer advocate. They're there to keep the operations moving forward.
What do you find to be the most pressing HR-related issue in the workplace today?
Well, at this point in time, employers are really stretched for the capacity for workers. They're having a difficult time finding talent due to the economy, and not just finding talent, but finding qualified talent that meet the requirements for the roles that we have in today's organizations.
And are human resources departments able to tackle some of the other issues, or are they really getting backlogged because they're having such of a hard time and so much of their time is going to try to fill open vacancies at companies?
They try their best, and wherever the greatest stressor is where the most resources are applied, as we can all kind of relate to. So they try to do an excellent balancing act, and some days there are better than others.
So for people who work in HR, they're kind of in this middle ground between the employee and the employer. You know, what are some, I guess, misconceptions out there about HR from both perspectives?
Well, sometimes HR is viewed as the enforcer of policy and that they only work on the employer side. And the same goes on the other side. Sometimes HR is viewed as being too much of an employee advocate and not facilitating the employer requirements that they have for the business need. So it goes both ways.
And what about companies that don't have a human resources department? A lot of places, you had mentioned individual before. Oftentimes there's an HR representative. Sometimes there's a department. But there are cases where an organization just doesn't have the resources to have a human resources department. What happens in that case, especially if an employee has a problem?
Well, that's a very good question. Sometimes employers are aligned with employer resource groups. Sometimes they do have a membership to the Society for Human Resource Management. There are many of us that do provide support and consulting to those smaller employers. Sometimes there are employer associations that can help fill that need. It's, you know, kind of a mixed grouping of things to try to help fill that resource.
And, you know, how do maybe a company that doesn't have an access to an HR department, how do they find these resources if they're just starting out and they're trying to figure out what to do in an employer situation?
Well, I would first refer them to either a SHRM Essentials course where they can, that's available to anyone from the Society of Human Resource Management. That's a wide variety of topics that range from the basics of HR to how to hire, how to reward your employees, how do you develop employees, et cetera, and also as well as the U.S. employment laws that are out there. So that would be one route. Employer associations oftentimes help provide a resource. And sometimes there are various legal firms that do employment law that put on seminars that can support them as well.
We're talking right now with Jeanette Black. She's an associate professor in the Department of Operations and Management at UW-Stout. And we're talking about human resources issues in today's workplace. And Jeanette, we've seen the emergence in recent years of the Me Too movement, of more of the spotlight being shown on some of the issues that women have faced at work in particular. And it's really forced employers to examine how gender and power often intersect. So describe what this has meant from an HR perspective.
Well, HR needs to be very well aware of what is happening in an organization in terms of those dynamics. And they also have to have strong policies in place that support reporting and process, as well as they need to do training. And training must be specific and related to their organization. And training really needs to be done more than once a year. It can't be just a one-time when we do all the annual training for all employees. It also is not just for the hourly employees. It's for all employees, supervisors, managers, upper leadership, etc. So everybody should know how to recognize the signs, how to communicate appropriately, and how to report. And on the flip side, HR really needs to know how to respond and what are those processes.
And I'm also wondering, you know, whenever there's kind of like an emerging issue, sometimes there can be a gap between when something is actually happening and then the training and the skills to actually be able to do something about it. And I'm wondering if we're seeing in human resources, a gap emerging, and what human resources departments are doing to be more proactive about things, to maybe be able to react to things more in the moment rather than waiting a couple months for that training to come down the road.
That's true. And really, we have a lot of technology that's available that human resource departments can do very quickly by putting out a quick web stream, et cetera, to get that out there right away. But HR really needs to be working with employees and supervisors and managers and upper leadership one-on-one and do that coaching real-time, one-on-one, and working with people and really have that pulse of the organization. What's happening, and make sure that there is truly an open door that people, no matter what the issue is, from what side, can come forward to talk about it in a non-threatening way with the support that they need.
Just a quick question, staying in the Me Too vein. Me Too really did explode on the scene. We saw a lot of stories come out. Was this a surprise from an HR perspective, or has this been simmering for a while?
Actually, it's been simmering for quite some time in organizations. It's just the media, the power of the media behind it with some of these high-profile situations that have happened have really accelerated. And I will say that some organizations, I think, were caught by surprise at how quickly the situation became and the topic became so broad and so widespread. I think that, you know, they were just surprised by that. And now every organization really needs to be aware of all these factors and really needs to also take a look at their diversity and inclusion processes and what do they mean.
I'm glad that you brought up diversity and inclusion, because that's another aspect of human resources that has been on a lot of minds in recent years. How are departments, human resource departments, handling issues of diversity and inclusion that you've seen? What kind of policies are they thinking about?
Well, they really need to be looking at what does diverse mean? Define that. Some organizations see it as ethnicity and stuff like that, but it's much broader. Diversity is also diversity of thought. How do we communicate in an organization? What type of talent do we need? And really look at those components to build a diverse workforce based on the talent requirements for the business.
So with diversity and inclusion, one thing we've heard somewhat is it's one thing to get people who do come from diverse backgrounds into the door, but what's there once they're in that work environment, especially if it's, say, a predominantly white work environment? What work is being done in HR now to make sure that these workplaces are open, inviting, and, safe for people coming in?
That's a very good point. And that boils down to what type of organizational culture and climate is present in the organization. What are those supposed rules of engagement for employees, as well as what are their experience and how are those components taught to new employees and how are they socialized into the organization? And are they welcomed? And are all views welcomed? I mean, there's a lot about looking at organizational culture from a people-centered point of view, where all people matter, all people are valued, all people are treated with dignity and respect. That goes a long way to building that inclusive organizational culture and climate that employers really need to be focusing on if they want to retain employees, especially with the newer generations coming in to organizations, because right now there can be anywhere between 5 and 6 generations in any workplace at any one point in time. So there can be a lot of conflict due to how do we bring people into the organization, how do we socialize them, how do we communicate, and how do we engage with them.
And Jeanette, we want to stick with the generational conversation. And we are talking to Jeanette Black right now about some of the human resources issues facing workplaces today. She's an associate professor in the Department of Operations and Management at UW-Stout. She's also a senior level human resources and organizational development professional.
And Jeanette, we said that word conflict, and I don't think it matters whatever organization or company that exists out there. There's always going to be conflict as long as people come together. So let's say someone has a conflict at work and they're wondering, well, you know, I don't know if this rises to the level of whether or not I should go to HR. What would you say to someone in that situation?
I would ask them to talk with the individual and see if their perceptions are accurate about the conflict. That gives an opportunity to have that one-on-one conversation. If the conflict intention still is there, I would talk with a supervisor, talk with HR, et cetera. Sometimes our perceptions can sometimes become an unfounded reality. So we need to take great care in how we perceive tension and conflict in organizations and make sure that's really valid. And if we have said something that may have stated unintentionally, we have an opportunity to apologize or correct that error.
It sounds like sometimes that apology can, you know, maybe stop the conflict in its tracks and you can move on. But what if, you know, people start taking the steps to alleviate that conflict and it isn't quite working? What advice do you have then?
Then I would suggest talking with a supervisor and your HR professional in your organization and just go in and say, hey, I've been talking with employee X and we had this conversation. It didn't go well. I tried to find out more and try to resolve it. I'd really like your perspective on what next steps I could try.
We also talked briefly before the break about, you know, different generations in the workplace. And we're getting to the point now where, you know, millennials have been in the workplace for a while. Gen Z is starting to get into the workforce. We've got baby boomers. We've got Gen X. There are a lot of different generations also coexisting under one roof a lot of the time. And that can lead to some general conflict. And I'm wondering how you go about having everyone kind of coexist happily together when there can be issues over, you know, experience versus newcomers and everything that goes along with different generations in the workplace.
Yes, that is kind of what a lot of employers are struggling with, and also retaining the employees from these most recent generations that are coming in to organizations. Again, a lot goes into and so revolves around socialization of new employees. Pairing new employees with employees who are more senior, mentoring programs, sponsorships, all of those go a long way. Now, that's more formal, but you can do something informal such as potlucks, dinners, outside activities. You know, right now it's a beautiful day in June here in Wisconsin. Outside picnics, et cetera, and just letting people to get to know each other. Team building activities can be involved in that. You'd be surprised how those even informal components can really break down barriers and establish really great working relationships. It's a lot about what we don't know about people is what drives our distance between people, and unfortunately, and creates those communication barriers.
Now, we've talked some about retention. You just mentioned it with some of the younger employees. It seems generationally that HR is going to have to respond to retention in different ways. How between, I would say, let's say baby boomers to Gen Z, which are now entering the workforce, how HR can work with each of these generations to make sure that all of their needs are being met?
That's a great question, and it's also one that organizations are really kind of challenged with right now. The first step that HR needs to embrace is talking with these groups and finding out what is meaningful for them. It's different for each group. It's different for the Generation Z. It's different for millennials. It's different for baby boomers, et cetera. They're all different. And once you find out and learn what those needs are, then you can develop more of a comprehensive package in terms of rewards and what that means. And what is that going to look like? But again, you can't just, okay, well, I got my feedback. I took it from the employees. Okay, good, I'm done. We're going to put this program in place. You still need to bring that back to employees within those generations for feedback. And then once again, revise as you need based on the growing changes and needs of the organization. It's not a one-time event. And organizations sometimes are so stressed, they think, oh, that's all I have time for. But everything doesn't need to sit on HR's shoulders. You can engage employees from these groups to help. And that's where a lot of companies have these small employee resource groups that really can lend a hand in helping drive and design the policies and procedures and total rewards programs for the company. And then it's well communicated because these groups do a great job of relating to and communicating with employees so that there's not as much of a gap between the employee base and management.
I'm also wondering, too, it sounds like, you know, from what you're saying, you know, HR plays a certain role in reaching out to employees, connecting people, and really just having conversations. And I'm wondering if that also needs to go to the other way, where maybe we need, as employees, to reach out to human resources a little bit more just on a personal level, because sometimes I think, you know, we joke around that, oh, we're only going to go to HR when we have a problem or something like that. And do we need to be a little bit more proactive in just having some of those general conversations, just getting to know our human resources representatives a little bit better?
Absolutely. It's a two-way street, per se. Employees need to share what they can about who they are and what they are about. And HR needs to do the same. I think we've become so worried about litigation that we kind of forget that we're not robots coming to work. Mm-hmm. We all have lives, we all have personalities, and we all have events that happen. And the most successful organizations, the most cohesive organizations I've worked with and I've been employed in have been those organizations where that sharing has occurred as appropriate.
You've given us a bit of a crash course in HR and the role that HR plays. You're actually going to be teaching a couple of new courses, looking at how to improve human resources. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're planning on teaching?
Certainly. July 15th and 16th on campus at UW-Stato, we'll be teaching the SHRM Essentials course. And that's available to anyone who wants to learn more about human resources. It can be employees, it can be supervisors, it can be HR, it can be leadership, doesn't matter. And we cover a wide range of topics, introductory topics to HR, such as what's the HR profession about, strategic planning, how do you acquire talent, what do rewards look like, what's meaningful, pay increases and compensation systems. We'll touch a little bit about that, benefits. How do you develop your employees? What's that career path look like? Performance management systems, and kind of the real basics of employment law. That's what that course will be. It'll be 2 days, partial days, on campus at UW-Stout, July 15th and 16th. And then starting on September 3rd, I will also be teaching 100% online the SHRM CP preparation course. And this is a 12-week course that's offered by SHRM. That goes through all of these topics in much more detail. It goes deeply into diversity, inclusion, and the generations in the workplace and stuff like that. So all of those things will be in that much longer 12-week course by SHRM. And it's there for people who are human resource professionals who want to be certified in the field, which today is really important.
briefly, Jeanette, as we wrap up, what challenges do you see on the horizon in the next 5 years or so that human resources departments all across the state might be facing?
I think that some of the challenges are we're going to have to think differently and be more engaged with our employees. And we're going to have to do things from a unique perspective. I don't believe that our existing or old models will work as our generations continue to expand into our workforce and as our older workforces retire. So we also need to get really involved with our communities, not outside of the four walls of the business, and create those community relationships.
Jeanette, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jeanette Black is an associate professor in the Department of Operations and Management at UW-Stout. She's also a senior-level human resources and organizational development professional. We talked with her about HR issues in the workplace.
Hound dog howling, the whistle blow. Train come a rolling, clickety-clack. Everybody trying to get a ticket to go, but those who go, they don't come back. They're going way down.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. The music you hear is from the award-winning Broadway musical Hadestown. The show received 14 Tony nominations and won 8 awards, including Best Musical at this year's ceremony.
It follows the Greek lyre player Orpheus as he travels to the underworld to try to save the love of his life.
The big night also brought a first for Andre DeShields, the veteran actor who plays the Greek god Hermes in Hadestown, his first Tony Award.
DeShields made a name for himself on Broadway as the title character in The Wiz in 1975 and also appeared in The Full Monty and numerous other productions.
Before that, DeShields was a student at UW-Madison. He kicked off his decades-long acting career here in Stuart Gordon's Peter Pan. Andre DeShields joins us now from New York. Andre, thanks so much for taking the time between rehearsals to join us today. And of course, congratulations on your Tony win. And can you just tell us a little bit about, what it has been like to work on this musical? It is one of many that you've been a part of, but what drew you to this show in particular?
This show has been in my life since 2012. One of the ways that Broadway shows experience their inception is to do workshops. In 2012, Anais Mitchell came down from Vermont and she did a workshop of this piece called Hadestown. It was my initial opportunity to invest my DNA in this character, and I also planted a boomerang in him, thinking that if it ever did experience a commercial iteration, it would come back into my life. It took 7 years, but here it has returned.
And, as we mentioned, you won a Tony Award for this. What was it like to be up on stage to receive the award after, a really storied career?
I've been a professional performing artist since 1969. 50 years I'm celebrating in 2019. The nomination for Hadestown is my third Tony nomination. And the universe loves Trinity. So I thought this might be my lucky time. It's the first time I've had, when accepting the award, I realized it's the first time I had a national audience, because I could perform on stage for the rest of my life and not reach the millions of people that I did that one time on June 9th Tony Awards when I thanked the powers that be for that award. So I used that opportunity to reach out to my hometown, Baltimore, and to reach out to those people who have personally invested in my career, and sort of leave them with some jewels to lead their professional lives by.
And you've said that the Tony has a special significance because of your parents. Can you talk a little bit about their relationship to the arts and, you wanting to fulfill kind of a debt or a destiny for them?
Yeah, actually, it's their absence of a relationship to the arts that tells my story. When I was old enough to have an adult conversation with my mother and father, my mom volunteered to me that she had always dreamed to be a dancer. Actually, the term she used was chorus girl. Now, her parents, my grandparents, did not allow her to pursue that dream. They didn't want a decent colored daughter of theirs to shuffle her way through life. Similarly, with my dad, who confessed that he wanted to be a singer, he was questioned by his parents, how are you going to make a secure life for your family with such a secure profession as a singer? So they deferred their dreams. I believe that I'm the lucky ninth of 11 children because when I was conceived, the Y and X chromosomes of those deferred dreams became the André Deshiels that you're talking to now. Two things are a result of that. First of all, I've never, ever doubted what my life's purpose is. And second, when I was born, I was put on my path of destiny.
You, we're talking to André Deshiels right now, the legendary Broadway actor, and of course from UW-Madison. And you know, your career and your journey has spanned from, you know, being a Baltimore native. You've been, of course, you were here in Madison for a while,
and you
kickstarted your professional career in Chicago. Can you talk a little bit about just your time in the Midwest and how that, you know, set the path for your years to come?
You say I kickstarted my career in Chicago.
Professional, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I wanted to parse that because my professional career started in Chicago in 1969 in the production of Hair with Tom O'Horgan. However, when I was at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, I worked with the Madison Rep when it was a community theater. And I was cast in a production of The Fantastics. And at 19 years of age, I got the opportunity to play El Gallo. So I like to use that as the starting point because it was 1968. No one was embracing as doctrines anyway diversity, equity, and inclusion. But there, the Madison Rep was doing exactly that by allowing me to play El Gallo. While there, on the campus of the university, I met Stuart Gordon, and it was there that I began my career in experimental theater and made a name for myself as an actor off campus, never on the main stage. But it's that combination of the work that I did in experimental theater with Stuart Gordon and the work that I did at the Madison Rep that made it possible for me to go to Chicago, audition for Hair, and land my first professional gig. So you refer to me as a legendary Broadway performer. I'd also like to think of myself as a lifetime legendary badger.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, we feel like a lot of UW Badgers, you know, take their time in Madison to heart. And, you know, you just mentioned Stuart Gordon and, you know, that play that you were in on campus was a pretty groundbreaking production of Peter Pan. Can you talk a little bit just about that production? Because it's not always top of mind for some people. And it really was groundbreaking.
It was groundbreaking. Remember, we're talking 1968. When not only the University of Wisconsin, but the entire country was losing its political innocence. And the theater company that Stuart Gordon had founded were young people who were testing the cultural status quo. I mean, we were the people who were protesting the America's participation in the Vietnam War. We were the students who were responsible for the first Black Studies department on that campus. We were the students who were part of the Mifflin Street riots. Mm-hmm. So we were the game changers. We were the people who wanted to be the change that we wanted to see in the world. What better way to express that in a theatrical way than to take a time-honored fairy tale and do a political overlay on it? So we chose Peter Pan. Now, again, we weren't embracing that doctrine of non-traditional casting. That term hadn't been invented. But what we did do was chop it up so that, for instance, one of the male students played Tinkerbell. Hmm. I played Tiger Lily, but I was a Tiger Lily that was easily confused with Huey Newton and the Black Panthers. Hmm. So that's the kind of storytelling we were doing with Peter Pan. Now, for those of us who remember the Peter Pan tale, the lost boys visit many exotic places, one of them an island filled with enchanting sirens. And in our daredevil approach to the play, the sirens were nude. Hmm. This caused a huge firestorm on the campus, involving the regents reaching out to the parents of those of us in the play so that we could have a big powwow about how we were spending our time when we were supposed to be pursuing higher knowledge. But what it appeared to the regents that we were doing was just making a mess of things. But out of that adventure, the Peter Pan adventure, have come my lifelong relationships. Stuart Gordon went on to return to his hometown of Chicago and found the nationally important Organic Theater Company, which later was the reason that I got to New York. A show that we did at the Organic Theater Company brought the company to New York. And after that show had finished its run, I decided to stay in New York, and the rest, I'm still trying to make history.
And Andre, you certainly have. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, especially between rehearsals. Good luck, and we're looking forward to seeing more from you.
Thank you very much. And please, please, if you have the opportunity, experience Hadestown and see the world the way it could be.
Thank you so much. That was Andre DeShields, a UW alumnus. We talked with him about his decades-long career and his recent Tony Award win for playing the character Hermes in the Broadway musical Hadestown.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jake Carlisle Larson.
We're going to talk about Milwaukee Bucks forward Giannis Antetokounmpo winning some big honors last night as he was voted the NBA's most valuable player. The voting by members of the media gave him a solid win over last year's MVP James Harden of the Houston Rockets and third place finisher Paul George of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Giannis gave an emotional acceptance speech thanking the Bucks organization, but especially his family.
Matt Velasquez is the Bucks beat reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins us now to talk about the award. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So was it any big surprise that Giannis won the MVP award last night?
You know, I don't think so. I think at the point of the end of the regular season, which is when the voting was done, it was pretty clear, at least to me, that Giannis was the favorite. He was the one who would likely end up receiving the award. I know he got my vote. I was one of the 100 or so voters part of the international group that voted for the award. And so I thought he would, and I prepared as though he would. And, you know, here we are.
Give us a sense of the kind of season that Giannis had. We remember him being in the playoffs, but he had a pretty monster season, if I remember correctly. What kind of numbers did he put up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was over 27 points a game, 12 rebounds, almost 6 assists. a block and a half per game, 1.3 steals. I mean, those are rare numbers to put up, especially with as few minutes as he played. You know, his minutes were down compared to last year, and he played much less than James Harden, for example. And if you extrapolate it out to per 36 minutes, as some, you know, stat heads like to do, he was over 30 points a game. I mean, he was just really great, really efficient, and doing it really all over the court, especially, you know, inside the restricted area, which is like, you know, right at the hoop, where he shot, you know, almost 74%, which is, you know, absolutely fantastic, especially considering that everyone on the court knows that Giannis is trying to get to the hoop, and they just weren't able to stop him.
One of the more remarkable things here is Giannis, you know, it feels like he's been in the league for a while, and he has, but he's only 24 years old. He's the third youngest player to win the MVP award over the past 40 seasons. I think when I was 24, I was an intern at Wisconsin Public Radio, so Giannis has a leg up on me. But this is a player who is clearly in his prime and clearly has many more years in the league. Matt, do you think this is the first MVP of many for Giannis, possibly?
I mean, I wouldn't put a ceiling on it, that's for sure. I think that, you know, with what he was able to do last year, you know, teams are obviously going to game plan for him differently and try to make things more difficult for him in the future. And maybe he'll try and figure out ways to keep his body fresher. I know that after the season, he talked about how hard he went in the regular season, and that might have, you know, dinged him up a little bit for the playoffs. And maybe in future years he's going to have to find ways to still play but not really assert himself all the time like he did this year. But I think that, you know, as he learns the game more, figures out the game more, figures out defenses more, and kind of, you know, adds to his skill set, you know, I think that he certainly has the capability of collecting more MVPs in the future.
We're talking right now with Matt Velasquez. He's the Bucks beat reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about some big honors for Giannis Antetokounmpo, who won the NBA's MVP award last night. And Matt, you know, when you're the MVP, you're kind of on top of the world. Every team wants you. We've seen players like LeBron James be courted by literally every team in the league. And when you're a player of that stature, you can kind of go where you want to. What do we know about Giannis's desire to stay in Milwaukee and keep playing for the Bucks?
The biggest thing for him is that he just wants to win. You know, he got the MVP award. It's an individual accolade that he was hoping for. But the biggest thing that he wants is a championship, and he's going to go wherever he believes he can win a championship. At least that's what he said. That's what he's put out there on a fairly consistent basis. He's still going to be with the Bucks for the next two seasons. He's still under contract. And so, you know, their ability to show that they can win and compete at the highest level is going to be paramount in their ability to keep him. I mean, it also helps that, you know, after this season, so at this point next summer, the Bucks will be able to offer him the richest contract ever handed out in the league, 5 years, $241 million or so. So they can offer that. No other team can offer that. That is the carrot at the end of the stick that they have and other teams don't. But, you know, he can still make, you know, boatloads of money elsewhere if he decided that the Bucks wouldn't be competitive enough for his liking.
We're also in the off season now, which means we're going to see trades, we're going to see transactions, we're going to see players being shuffled around with Giannis winning the MVP award. Milwaukee's looking like a pretty good place to play right about now. Does this award really sort of affect Milwaukee's ability to go out and get some of these players that they really want to get and build the team around Giannis?
Not really. I mean, maybe it will help with getting some kind of fringe guys, and maybe adding guys who might be willing to take a pay cut because they want to play in Milwaukee. They want to play with Giannis. I think it's important to also mention that, you know, general manager John Horst won executive of the year last night. Coach Mike Budenholzer won coach of the year. So to have that kind of alignment where you have the front office, you know, the coach and the best player winning the league's top awards, that's rare. And that's something that, you know, that may entice people to come. But the biggest difficulty, the biggest hurdle for the Bucks in that regard is the salary cap. They're very close to that salary cap number. They can go over it to sign their own free agents. They can bring back Chris Middleton. They can bring back Malcolm Brogdon. They have the right to do that with those guys. But in order to bring back Brook Lopez, someone who they had last year, but they haven't had long enough to have his rights, they're going to have to open up cap space to keep him. And if they want to bring back George Hill, they'll have to open up cap space and that just, you know, whittles away the money they'd have for other guys. So it's a really tough puzzle for general manager John Horst, and he's got a couple of days to start figuring that out, and free agency will be here by Sunday.
Well, Matt, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Matt Velasquez is the Bucks beat reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about Giannis Antetokounmpo winning the NBA's MVP award last night. That is a hard sentence to say, and I've said it several times. The Bucks have announced that there will be a celebration of the award on July 14th at Deer District Plaza. More details are going to be released about that soon. And share your favorite memories of the season with Giannis. Head on over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, share your memory, share a favorite highlight, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. If there's one thing you should know about JC and I, it's that we both have a deep appreciation for weird food news. And when it comes from Wisconsin, well, it's all the better.
And that is absolutely true. For those of you out there, you might be familiar with glazers, those Krispy Kreme-like donuts found at quick trips across the state. Now, the mad food scientists at the Wisconsin-based gas station chain have introduced a new product, Glazers Potato Chips.
Yeah, I love this. The idea of Glazers Potato Chips initially started as an April Fool's Day joke, but the combination of donut and chip could not be denied. You know, we had talked a little bit about whether or not we should
go and get them, potentially.
Yeah.
We did not have time.
So you're on board with the idea?
Oh, yeah. Dude, come on. It's chips. It's sweet. It's savory. It's crunchy. It sounds like it kind of hits all of my snack food requirements. They're not spicy, but I feel like beyond that, I'm for it.
Yeah, see, my problem is, you know, if I go into a Quick Trip and I go up to the counter, I don't intend to buy Glazers, but then someone always says, oh, you know, do you want to have a dozen of them for like $2 or whatever discounted price they're at? Then it's like, okay, yeah, I guess I'll do that then. So I'm worried that that's how they're going to get me with the chips, too.
I am a little afraid to admit this. I'm not entirely sure I've been to a Quick Trip. Yeah, I probably shouldn't admit that.
Unpack
but,
that one off yeah. the air.
Oh, man. All right. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.